People don't seem to believe it when I say it, so I will say it again. The market doesn't care what politicians think. The coal economy today and the war thereon. From American Public Media, this is Market Flash. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, the 10th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. At the risk of letting facts get in the way of a good political tagline, we begin today with a declaration by EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt that the war on coal is over, specifically the Trump administration's decision to get rid of rules cutting greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. Here, though, is the fact. In the real economy of the energy markets, not a whole lot is going to change. If you watch investments in coal mines and power plants, this industry built on the dirtiest form of power production, it is still fighting to survive for reasons that have nothing to do with what happens in Washington, D.C. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going.
Here in D.C., the announced repeal of the Clean Power Plan has invigorated what we'll call the influence market, the manufacturing of talking points and legal briefs. But in the real market, where energy is made, no new coal-fired power plants have broken ground since November 2008. Robert Godby at the University of Wyoming says today's news brings some psychological relief in coal country.
But the reality is still that the coal sector faces some really severe challenges, and the most significant one is from alternative sources of energy.
That is, natural gas and renewable energy selling for cheaper. He says a clean power plant in limbo means coal production will remain somewhat steady in the West, where it's cheapest to mine, not in the East.
Those areas that have been most impacted, primarily in Appalachia, regardless of whether the clean power plant is in effect or not, you're going to probably continue, unfortunately, for those workers to see a decline.
It's part of a long story. In the last century, coal mining jobs went from 800,000 to just one-tenth of that. Miners lost work to machines and then to competing forms of energy. And now coal's environmental cost has prompted policy just about everywhere, says Trevor Hauser at the Rhodium Group.
While we have a political debate about that here in the U.S., there's not the same political debate in the rest of the world. And that's the way that policy is moving in China and India and Europe. We're definitely looking at a structural decline in coal consumption.
He says the only question is how fast. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you haven't yet had a chance, I encourage you to read the report in the New Yorker magazine today, adding to and amplifying the allegations first published in the New York Times of sexual misconduct by film producer Harvey Weinstein, including three women accusing Weinstein of rape. Weinstein denies the allegations, which span decades, but our story today is one of speed, the head-spinning speed at which the Weinstein Company and Hollywood in general is trying to un-Harvey itself. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
It's one thing to fire the boss, and another when that boss is the driving force behind the company, and his name has shown up in more Oscar speeches than God.
There are advantages and disadvantages, clearly, to having so much of the brand equity put into one person's name or brand.
That's Gene Grabowski, a crisis management expert at K Global. The Weinstein Company has one advantage, says Karen Post, who wrote the book Brand Turnaround. Unlike other tainted company founders like Martha Stewart or Lance Armstrong, she says,
the straight-up consumer that's not as aware of his name probably doesn't even give two thoughts about it when they're deciding to go to a movie or to watch a television show or to enjoy a product that he created.
Actors, distributors, and advertisers do, though. Elizabeth Toledo with Camino Public Relations says winning back their trust will take more than a name change.
They need to make some significant efforts to tell their communities that they are truly engaging in reform.
Another possibility is a sale. Jason Squire is editor of the Movie Business Book.
It really puts the company in play and a target for acquisition. And it makes them terribly vulnerable.
The Weinstein Company's vast film library includes hits like The King's Speech and Lion. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
When you get into your car or you get on a plane, you count on a whole lot of things going right, including that the companies that make the basic materials for whatever conveyance it is that you are in did their jobs. That's why it was troubling to learn today that Japan's Kobe Steel admitted falsifying strength data for some of its rolled aluminum. Aluminum that, of course, goes into those cars and planes. Marketplace's Jed Kim has today's supply chain story.
A lot of big-name companies get at least some of their metals from Kobe Steel. Toyota, Honda, Mitsubishi, Boeing. Investigations are being done to see just how the potentially subpar aluminum was used. The good news is it should become clear if your car has this suspect material. Sam Abul-Samid is a senior analyst with Navigant Research.
The manufacturers would know exactly which vehicles each roll of aluminum or other metal went into, so it can be traced down to individual vehicles.
If it's in a car's hood or door, that can be replaced relatively inexpensively. But if it's found to be welded into the frame, well,
we're talking potentially tens of thousands of dollars if you have to scrap an entire vehicle.
As for planes, Boeing wouldn't give an interview, but a spokesman said it's continuing an investigation of its entire supply chain. And, quote, nothing in our review to date leads us to conclude that this issue presents a safety concern. It's not yet clear who'd be on the hook for any repairs or recalls that may have to be done, but there could be a wider economic impact. Martin Dresner teaches logistics and supply chain management at University of Maryland's School of Business.
The whole Japanese manufacturing industry could take a hit, that perhaps products that are made there are not quite as reliable as we had thought.
He says Japanese manufacturing had worked hard in recent decades to get equated with quality. This incident, on the heels of the Takata airbag scandal, also questionable quality controls at Nissan, could cause some to rethink that. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street keeps on going up, and even the newest economics Nobel laureate doesn't quite get it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. An interesting thing happened on the way to renegotiating NAFTA today. The president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Tom Donahue, the pro-business, generally favorably disposed to Republican points of view U.S. Chamber of Commerce, called the Trump administration's negotiating tactics on that trade deal an existential threat to it. Donahue's comments come as negotiations to overhaul NAFTA resume this week, and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is set to meet with the president tomorrow. Jake Schlesinger covers trade for the Wall Street Journal. Jake, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Review for me, would you, some of the big issues on the table as round, what is it, three of these negotiations?
Four.
Round four gets going. I know, right? So what are the big issues on the tables, I guess?
So, I mean, broadly, there are a bunch of things that the U.S. has held off proposing but is expected to propose in this round. What they would do is, in essence, weaken the broader tone of NAFTA. They're talking about injecting a sunset provision that would make it expire automatically, and thus the countries automatically try and agree to renew it. They're talking about imposing stricter rules of origin for cars within the trade agreement.
Can we take a step back here and talk about trade more broadly? There was an editorial, in fact, over the weekend in the Wall Street Journal talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how American absence from that deal since the president pulled us out of it is working to American exporters and American businesses' deficit.
Pretty much, you know, since the end of the war, successive U.S. administrations of both parties have had as a goal in some form advancing free trade agreements, advancing the coverage of free trade rules. And this is the first administration that has essentially hit the pause button and said, we're not going to advance further until we can take a hard look at how this has all worked or not. And NAFTA is not just about NAFTA. It's really the first test case of this new world in which an American White House is taking a very different look at trade.
But also, you know, Orrin Hatch, who's arguably the chief trade guy in the Senate, said he's looking for a unified American position on this as we continue with these negotiations. And it certainly seems that that is not what we have.
Right. So, you know, specifically, it was issued in response to the Chamber of Commerce complaints, which was, look, we've never had a trade agreement that did not have strong American business support. It's hard to envision a trade agreement that doesn't have strong American business support. Not that we have to give them everything that they want, but that we certainly need them excited and behind this proposal. And you're not seeing that. And I think, you know, what's indicative of Senator Hatch's comments is not just that there's not business support behind the White House, but he does not have congressional Republicans behind him. And while some of the liberal Democrats who've long been trade critics, I think, are interested in what they're doing, a lot of Democratic leaders who've been pro-trade are also very worried about this.
Here we have, then, the first CEO president, ran as a populist, is having the very devil of a time with trade, which was arguably like in his top three campaign positions. Where does this go then?
Well, that is the big question. Where does it go? You know, the president is doing in some ways exactly what he said he would do. I mean, he campaigned saying he would change the sort of longstanding consensus on trade, said it was badly misguided and that he wanted to change the direction. You know, the White House has a lot of powers. I mean, the president does have the power, if he wants, to just pull out of NAFTA altogether. Now, that would itself create huge blowback. I'm guessing that if that happened, you know, you'd see lawsuits, you'd see Congress trying to stop him. But, you know, I think he's trying to change the debate. And I guess you could say at a minimum at this point, he certainly has changed the tenor of the debate.
It has been changed. Jake Schlesinger covers trade for The Wall Street Journal. Jake, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Just as trade seems to have disappeared from the top of the president's agenda, so too has infrastructure. Remember the campaign promise, right? Fixing roads and airports and bridges with a $1 trillion combination of public and private money. Now the president has told lawmakers he is not interested in that model anymore. Tom Scheck from the investigative group APM Reports has the story.
Trump's about-face came during a private meeting on the tax bill with a bipartisan group of lawmakers, says Democratic Congressman Brian Higgins of New York. He says the president, unprompted, bashed public-private partnerships, or P3s. That's when government cuts deals with investors to finance big projects.
He said that they were more trouble than they're worth. He went on for a couple of minutes about all the problems with public-private partnerships.
Higgins says Trump then pointed to Vice President Mike Pence and said P3s didn't work in Pence's home state of Indiana. The problems there include a northern Indiana toll road that declared bankruptcy. The state had to get a new operator. Plus, a plan to extend Interstate 69 in southern Indiana is facing huge delays. This stance is a major shift for the president. For nearly a year, Trump has pushed P3s as the key to paying for hundreds of projects across the country. He touted the approach during the campaign and at White House events, like this meeting of city and state officials in June.
My budget proposal includes a massive investment in new federal support for infrastructure. These dollars will be matched by significant private, state, and local dollars for maximum efficiency and accountability.
The White House did not respond to our questions as to why the administration may be reversing course or whether private investment has been taken off the table completely. Todd Herbergs runs the National Council for Public-Private Partnerships. He says P3s are an important tool. They can make more projects happen and faster than relying on direct government spending.
As an industry, we just want public entities, whether they be federal, state, local, to be able to use P3s as an option.
Critics of P3s say they result in fees and tolls to pay back the private money. That's unpopular with the public at large and puts an unfair burden on the poor. Donald Cohen is with a union-backed group called In the Public Interest. He's not convinced that Trump will take private finance off the table.
It's pretty challenging to do what they say they still want to do, meaning $1 trillion of infrastructure, without using private capital if they can't get the Congress to actually spend real money.
Meaning getting Congress to possibly raise taxes, particularly the gas tax, or to borrow money to fund infrastructure. Both are long shots. Trump's preference on how to pay for big projects may have changed, but the stalled status of his infrastructure plan remains the same. I'm Tom Scheck for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Today we're going to do the metric system.
Metrics.
All right. What's 2 liters?
Man, nobody said there was going to be a test. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 0.3%. Today, 69 points, 22,830. The NASDAQ up about 0.1%, 7.6587.
S&P 500 up 0.2%, about 5 points, 25 and 50. Biotechnology and pharmaceuticals leader Pfizer says it's considering whether to sell or spin off its consumer health business. It gained 0.7% today on that news. Competitors, Novartis AG down 0.6%. Merck & Company picked up about 0.2%. J.P. Morgan Chase is among the giant financial institutions reporting earnings later this week. On the heels of dethroning Bank of America yesterday as the biggest holder of deposits, get this, 11% of total U.S. bank deposits, J.P. Morgan Chase up 0.7% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.35%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Silicon Valley and its financiers have a track record of trying to convince us that things in our everyday lives have become boring and that tech can do better. It's happened with books, with music, and with food. Now venture capitalists are coming for your socks. Sarah McBride wrote recently about foot garment disruption for Bloomberg. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
I will tell you, I read a phrase in this story that I have, I don't think, ever come across before. A premium sock startup is what this company Stance is. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a company that makes socks that have caught the eye of a lot of people. Tons of celebrities wear them. Prime Minister Trudeau even wore them on stage at the UN recently. And they've attracted the eye of a lot of venture capitalists who usually invest in AI and the cloud and lots of really tech-heavy things and decided to give this sock company $110 million.
And we are talking here, the granddaddy, one of the granddaddies of venture capital in Silicon Valley, Kleiner Perkins, is in on this thing. What do they see in socks?
Well, they used a lot of words that they usually use for other types of companies. They told me the sock industry needed disrupting.
Oh, man.
They said it was wildly misunderstood and that there's an opportunity for somebody to come in and dominate it in the way that Nike dominates shoes.
Socks
made a good case, I have to say.
Well, so tell me about the case that the company made, because it's clear in your article that while it is a sock company, it's not about socks, right?
Right. It's not about socks at all. In fact, the CEO was very open about liking brands. He was on the board of Skull Candy, the headphones maker for many years, and he just wanted to find a brand that he could build up. So he went about this in a very methodical way. He identified all kinds of attributes he wanted to see, and he didn't care what the company was. He described literally walking up and down the aisles at Target, looking at things like sunblock and luggage, and he just kept coming back to socks, and he realized that was where he thought he could make his mark.
Okay, so here's the question, though. I know you know of, and our listeners will know of, Juicero, the $700 internet-capable juice thing that got a gazillion dollars from venture capitalists and just recently went bust. Is there too much VC money out there if we're putting $110 million into socks?
Okay, well, that is the billion-dollar question.
Yeah.
So everybody for years has been saying, oh, there's way too much money going into venture capital.
Mm-hmm.
But then you keep hearing these astounding stories of success in this area. There's a pet food company in Florida called Chewy. People love Chewy. It had some venture money. It raised about the same amount as Stance. And it sold to PetSmart this year for $3.35 billion.
Wow.
These VCs are trying to tell do we have the next Juicero on our hands, or do we have the next Chewy on our hands?
It's interesting what this company has done just in terms of building its business, I suppose. They've got a chief technology officer for socks that they hired away from an Israeli sock company. They're going all in.
Oh, sure. So even though they say we're not a tech company, they're making it as technologically forward as I think it's possible to make a sock company. I saw so many contraptions and testers at their headquarters in San Clemente. I began to wonder if they even needed all of them. But they can do these incredible things, stretch socks to giant sizes, make sure their socks are cooling faster than competitors' socks.
How,
it's pretty incredible.
How much is it going to cost me if I want to buy a pair of Stance socks?
That's the rub. could cost you like $30,
even more for some of those socks.
Yep.
Get out.
It could also cost you $10.
Okay,
that's
I'll take
still
10.
Pricey considering. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sarah McBride at Bloomberg writing about socks and venture capital. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is, in case you'd missed it somehow, National Metric Week. It falls on the week of the year that contains the 10th of October, the 10th day of the 10th month. Think about it for a second. Metrics, tens. And that makes today the perfect day for the metric edition of our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Today's question comes to us from Matthew Hooks in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Why, Matthew wonders, are bottles of soda sold in liters but milk is sold in gallons? Both, he rightly points out, are consumable liquids, so what gives? Marketplace's Annie Baxter has what gives.
To answer this question, we need to go back to the year 1970, back when scores of Americans could probably sing along to this catchy jingle. Things go better with Coke.
Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola, things go better with Coca-Cola.
Things were not going well for Pepsi, though. Coke outsold it 10 to 1 in about half the country.
So we were a very distant second-tier brand to Coca-Cola.
That's John Sculley. He was president and CEO of Pepsi from the late 70s into the 80s. And after that, he led the tech giant Apple. But when this story begins, Sculley was just 29 and newly hired to up Pepsi's game against Coke. He says even Coke's bottles were hard to beat.
The Coke bottle was the perfect shape for a vending machine to go down a bottling line and not get broken. It was a classic, very memorable design.
His first assignment was to spiff up Pepsi's bottles. He started doing market research on Pepsi drinkers. And along the way, he learned that households were constantly running out of Pepsi. That led to an epiphany.
Why are we spending our time trying to design a little glass bottle when what we should really be doing is figuring out how do we get more liquid, more Pepsi, into that household?
Sculley wanted a bigger vessel. He worked with the chemical company DuPont, which had come up with a new form of plastic, perfect for bigger beverage bottles. The result? A Pepsi bottle that was 10 times bigger than the classic 6.5-ounce Coke. And its name, the 2-liter, reflected the nation's flirtation with going metric. It was an effort to get the U.S. to give up customary measurements like inches or pints and join the rest of the world in using the metric system. Here's a vintage Pepsi ad from that era.
Today we're going to do the metric system.
Metric.
All right. What's 2 liters?
This is 2 liters.
The new returnable, resealable 2-liter bottle from Pepsi Cola.
Stephen Mim at the University of Georgia has a book coming out on the history of measurement systems. He says the U.S. has debated going metric on and off since the 1800s. But the 1970s, that was the last time the idea gained momentum.
That was driven by concerns in the late 1960s of declining American exports abroad. And that got chalked up, rightly or wrongly, to our intransigence about not adopting the metric system.
In 1975, the U.S. Congress passed the Metric Conversion Act. It didn't mandate that companies sell their products in metric sizes. Instead, it laid out a way to convert voluntarily. Jack McKinney directs the Dr. Pepper Museum in Waco, Texas. It includes artifacts from other brands also owned by the parent company, like 7-Up. And he says during this metric fever, you could buy 7-Up in half-liter and liter sizes.
They adopted a new slogan for this campaign called Follow the Leader.
And he says 7-Up even published a 60-page guide for teachers on the metric system.
And they circulated it through their bottlers, and their bottlers could give it to teachers and schools, and it's quite comprehensive.
But the effort was short-lived. Protectionist forces in the U.S. prevailed, and the metric idea got dropped, as evidenced by all the stuff we don't measure in metric units, like milk. Sarah Brew specializes in product labeling laws at the firm Faegre Baker Daniels in Minneapolis. She says, unlike a global soda brand, milk is sold locally and follows local customs of measurement.
Going back to the days when consumers got their milk delivered by the milkman to their doors, milk has historically been sold in pints and quarts and gallons, and that's what consumers expect.
So these two systems are now in play when you do your grocery shopping, and that could be confusing for consumers. That's why Congress made manufacturers list products' contents in both metric units and traditional inches, pounds, gallons, etc. But at the end of the day, they can market the size however they like. Hence, liters of soda, but gallons of milk. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today comes to us courtesy of Bloomberg Television. They had Richard Thaler on. As we said yesterday, Thaler just won the Nobel for his work in behavioral economics. Anyway, Bloomberg TV asked him what he thought behaviorally about the stock market. Here you go.
We seem to be living in the riskiest moment in our lives, and yet the stock market seems to be napping but being pushed up by some snail.
Which I think is the Nobel equivalent of a shrug. I don't know. All right, we are out of here. The Dow was up. The NASDAQ was up. The S&P 500 up about a tenth, two-tenths all the way around. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team is Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.